You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 46, All Roads Lead to Stun. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the Walter Koenig Star Celebration, the final flight of the Space Shuttle Enterprise, autograph and photo pricing for Destination Star Trek London, the international premiere of Trek Nation, and some new rumors and speculation about the next J.J. Abrams movie. Then in the feature, we're joined by Sean Taranjo and Michael Fisher as we discuss the classic TOS episode, Amok Time. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I will follow you into the Antares Nebula and around Perdition's Flame. I'm doing well.
Good. So, boy, it sounds like you've had quite a con weekend there.
Con!
So tell us, what was the big event, Greg, this weekend for you?
Yeah, so the Cinerama Theater in Seattle, I don't know if anyone's listening to this has been there, but it's this huge theater renovated by Paul Allen, and they are doing basically a sci-fi movie festival, film festival this weekend and last. They got a lot of new prints of sci-fi films and a lot of 70mm prints. And last night, well, I guess a couple nights ago as we're recording this, was the big Wrath of Khan screening. They had a nice 70mm print of Wrath of Khan, and the screening was sold out. It was packed full of people. Wow. I don't know, Chris, were you there in 1982 for the original theatrical Wrath of Khan?
Yeah, I was, but I was 10 years old, so I don't really remember it, and I would not have taken it in, you know, the same way I'm right now either.
Well, I imagine even if you were the most rabid Star Trek fan going to see it with a bunch of other rabid Star Trek fans, there's no way in 1982 you could have had the response to the film that I saw last night. I mean, everyone was clapping, you know, opening credits, you know, Shatner gets an applause, Nimoy gets applause, Walter Koenig gets applause, George Takei gets huge applause. George Takei's name brings the house down. All these lines throughout the film, little looks between actors, everything's getting laughs, getting applause. I've never seen a reaction to a film like this. It was pitch perfect.
Wow, very interesting. So how large was the screening room? How many people were there?
It's a massive wraparound screen. And I have to estimate, you know, in the 200, 250 range, very possibly more than that, though. I might be really lowballing it. It was packed full of people. There were at least, I mean, let me do a little bit of math in my head, 30 to 40 people per row, and then 20 rows. So I guess, yeah, I was lowballing it. A lot of people in that movie theater, and every single one of them a giant Star Trek fan, people who've seen this movie multiple times.
Did they come out in costume and uniforms?
There were a few people in costume, but not as many as I would think. You know, I did see a few people, you know, someone was wearing the Rock, Paper, Scissors, Spock shirt from Big Bang Theory. Yeah. I should mention, before the screening, I went out to dinner with a few of our listeners, actually, a couple of our listeners, I suppose, and then some of the people we know on Twitter, ClayStation X, XMXP, and then David, who we know is Sci-Fi Commons, Amy Herndon, a few people, you know, big Star Trek fans. And it was a lot of fun meeting some of these people. But I guess Clay was wearing a Starfleet Academy shirt. I think it might have been like softball from the varsity softball team.
Oh, I've seen
Starfleet
that one,
Academy.
Yeah. So was there anyone there like rocking the Khan prosthetic chest cosplay, anything like that?
I was considering it. You know, I was first just going to go with my own chest, and then I realized no one's going to understand.
You're going to get thrown out of the theater.
Yeah, exactly. Get that thing out of here. But then, you know, I was considering getting a prosthetic. I couldn't get it cast in time, and things just didn't come through. But hopefully next time I'll have my prosthetic chest. Yes, for sure.
Did you get the special collector's poster, the "Why Are They Using SETI Ills in Theaters This Spring" poster?
Ah, that's another thing about the screening, the reaction to the SETI Ills. The girl I was with had not actually seen this film before, so her reaction was definitely understandable. But even everyone else was just disgusted by the SETI Ills. I mean, just seeing them on the big screen is so different from seeing it on your television. And as fake as the rubber ears look, you know, they built like these oversized ears, yeah, and then had the little puppet going into it with the, yeah. As fake as it looks on a TV, it looks horrible and just horrifying on the big screen. And everyone was squirming in their seats for that.
Yeah, I would be. I really don't like that scene.
It's terrible. I think they even cut part of it for the TV version.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I don't care much.
Yeah, another thing about Wrath of Khan that gets me, it has two vaporizations, which I think I've talked about in the podcast. It really gets me when someone's vaporized by a phaser.
Yeah, you mentioned
that. And
that
happens twice in this film. And it's just, horrible.
Well, it sounds like an exciting night anyway. I wish I could have been there.
Certainly was.
It's one of the drawbacks for me being in Tokyo is there's not many Star Trek fans around, and we don't have much opportunity to do these kind of things.
Yeah, it was so worth going out. One thing I also want to note is the movie moves like a bullet. It was over before I really had realized it started. I was like, wait, they're setting off the Genesis device? But I got here just a minute ago. So I'm definitely, the next time there's a Wrath of Khan screening, I'll be there again because I want to catch all the things that move past me so fast during this one.
Are you sure that's not because to get ready to watch the Wrath of Khan the night before you watch the motion picture? So you felt like this was just really going by quickly?
That is very true. And you know, they reuse a lot of shots from the motion picture near the start of Wrath of Khan, but they're cut. You know, they use like a fourth of the shot in Wrath of Khan. So it's like a 2-minute sequence rather than like a, you know, a 20-minute sequence.
All right. Well, that sounds really nice. I'll say I just had, right before the show here, I was on the Delta Quadrant, and we were talking about Tattoo. And that was quite an interesting experience. And as we wrapped that up, Greg, I was asked by Matt to make a bet on how many times you were going to mention Battlestar Galactica. Because I carried the torch for the Ready Room, Greg. I did. I mentioned Battlestar Galactica twice during the Delta Quadrant. So I'm not sure if they're going to have sound clips or not, but they might.
Well, yeah, I brought my sound clip machine with me to dinner last night. Because I kept bringing up Battlestar Galactica over the course of the evening. So every time I did, I just went ahead and played it. So say we all, you know.
Did you get that app for the iPad, the soundboard app, where you can program it? Right. Yeah, just tap it. You carry that around with you everywhere, right?
Right.
Also, you have barrel roll on there, too.
Yes, I do. Oh, there was the barrel roll in Wrath of Khan. No, not Wrath of Khan. I was watching Best of Both Worlds this morning. And I was like, barrel roll. I was really excited.
The best moment in the whole episode.
I wish there were barrel rolls in other series. Like, why isn't there a barrel roll in Game of Thrones?
I think you need to write in, make some suggestions there, Greg.
I should.
All right. Well, why don't we jump into our news lineup today? And Greg, the first story we have is about Walter Koenig getting his star and the star celebration. Now, Greg, are you familiar with the actor Walter Koenig?
Well, of course I am, Chris. I never forget a face. I believe he played, he was Chekhov in, was it the, he was going to be Chekhov in phase, no, wait. The later films, right? He came in sort of later, like Star Trek V. He was like comedic relief.
Yeah, he's the one that fell off the ship and ended up in the hospital.
Right.
No, Walter Koenig, Chekhov, who later in this episode, in the feature, we're going to talk about Amok Time. And, you know, one of the great moments of Amok Time for me is the first time we see Chekhov when they cut across to him sitting there at navigation, and he has his monkey's hair on.
Yes. Oh, Chekhov. He's he's so much. He's just there to be funny in the original series, and then they give him nothing to do in the movies, really. It's kind of sad, but he's a big part of the show. I think everyone remembers Chekhov, and I certainly am glad that they made a big deal out of him in the new film, giving him, like, he's like this whiz kid now that's like a genius right out of high school.
Yeah, maybe he will have more to do. I mean, it's a case of all the supporting cast in the original series had very little to do. And you know, the whole background story about how he ended up on the show. And George Takei was off filming, and he couldn't film the first few episodes of second season, I guess it was. Mm-hmm. And so they brought in Koenig to play Chekhov, and he was also kind of modeled after the Monkees, actually, to you know, get that young teen girl audience. So
yes, bring in those girls. Yeah, I was watching Space Seed the other night, and it's like, where's Chekhov? It's like you feel that he's not only that Khan remembers him, and there's that whole story that Koenig tells at conventions where they met in like the lavatory or something.
Yeah.
But you really feel that Chekhov's missing, because there's just some random guy at the con.
Well, they did meet. I mean, we just didn't see it on camera. You know, those scenes were cut, because back then you don't want to show bathroom scenes. And even if you could, I mean, you can't do it in Star Trek, because you just have to maintain that belief that there are no bathrooms on starships. Everyone, they just open an airlock and, you know, take a leak out the ship. I don't know.
Yes, in space, no one can hear you pee.
Thank goodness. But I guess that's how it works. But anyway, to the real news story here, as we mentioned on a previous Ready Room, and everyone knows from news now, Walter Koenig is finally getting his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and that's going to happen on September 10th. And they're planning this huge star celebration. It's going to be September 8th through 10th in Hollywood, and it's organized by Planet Expo. And it's astonishing. I mean, the number of people that are coming out here to be part of the ceremony for Koenig's star is truly impressive.
Yeah, I didn't realize that this many people had connections to Koenig or felt an affinity to Star Trek. I mean, you got people like Richard Hatch in there, who is a original Battlestar Galactica actor, had a bit part on the new show. He's there. Larry Nemechek is coming out, friend of the show. But I mean, of course, a bunch of Star Trek people, like people from the original series, but you know, you got even Tim Russ in there, who's just a guy from Voyager. It's great to see that.
Just a guy from Voyager.
Well, I would expect maybe you try to get as much of the original series cast as you can to come out and have a photo op. But this looks like this is going to be like a really big deal come this September.
It is. You mentioned them, of course, Harlan Ellison.
Yeah.
Alan Ruck, who everyone knows, one of the five great captains who will be at Destination Star Trek London.
Right.
You've got, of course, Larry Nemechek will be there as well. And
Bruce Boxleitner.
Yeah.
You know, he never misses a Star Trek event.
And Gary Lockwood, Nichelle Nichols, of course, and Leonard Nimoy will be there. It's quite amazing. And of course, Michael Straczynski, who created Babylon 5, will be there, because Koenig played a key role on that series as well. So,
right.
If you are going to be in the Hollywood area September 8th through 10th, and even if you're not and you can make your way there, plan a trip, really quite an event to go to. So if you go over to planetexpo.com, that's planetexpo.com. You can find all kinds of information. And there's also a congratulations video up there from Mike and Denise Okura to Walter Koenig. And great moment, and a big congratulations to Walter. And we're really happy that yet another, I believe the final of the TOS cast, correct, to get their star on the Walk of Fame.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. And of course, you know, Harry Kim is still an ensign.
Forever and always. All right, Craig, what do we have up next in news this week?
We have what kept hitting the major, like the mainline news, was this photo op by NASA where they were bringing the Space Shuttle Enterprise to the Smithsonian for its final resting place. So they sort of did a flyover of New York City, let everyone take pictures. I don't know if you've seen, but a bunch of people posting pictures on Twitter of like the 747 with the, you know, the 1701 Enterprise on top of it, which would have been a thing to see.
Well, that's how they, in the Abrams verse, that's how they got the Enterprise off the ground in Iowa up into space, right? They put it on the back of a special modified 747 and just flew it right up there.
One of these days, we're going to do a whole show on why it makes sense to build starships on Earth. It does. Come on, people. We're gonna do a whole show on it. But yes, they put it on a 747. By then, they have like 7, like 97s, 720s.
Right. Probably the 897s. Yeah, we've already got a 787 now, I believe, recently, new jets. So, but this is a nice moment.
It has it. The one thing that bugs me about this is that the Enterprise was the first space shuttle they made, and it never went into space. Yeah. It was never supposed to go into space. It was, you know, they did fly it on the 747, let it go, let it land. But it was just a test. And it's great that the first space shuttle was an Enterprise, but the whole point of having one named the Enterprise is to have that be something furthering space travel. And it's kind of sad that it wasn't.
Well, yeah, it would have been nice if maybe the Columbia had been the ship that was named Enterprise, because this was a prototype. So on the one hand, the way that Star Trek fans got together and pushed for NASA to name this shuttle Enterprise was wonderful, but maybe they did jump the gun just a little bit. Because it would have been nice. What would have been nice would have been, say, if Discovery, which ended up being the most used shuttle of all the shuttles, had been Enterprise. Yeah. You mentioned the Smithsonian. So what they're actually doing here, Greg, is the Enterprise actually has been in the Smithsonian. But
it's being replaced
by Discovery, because Discovery was the true workhorse of the shuttle fleet. So they're moving the Enterprise to the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York.
And that's what I meant to say, yes.
Yeah, that's where they're transporting it. And the whole shuttle program for me is interesting because I remember very clearly the first launch of Columbia, the very first space shuttle launch. I even remember where I was. I remember I was in the laundry room of the apartment complex where we lived at that time when I was a kid. And there was a little TV in the laundry room, and I remember watching the shuttle launch at that time.
Wow.
So the whole shuttle program for me has been kind of like the lifelong journey of Star Trek kind of coming to life for me.
Yeah. And I love that they're doing, reusable spacecraft, because, you know, that's the Star Trek future, not just launching rockets into space and dropping them down in parachutes, but actually taking the same ship into space over and over again, repairing it. You know, but it was an experiment with the shuttle, of course, because they learned that ships take a whole lot of beating when they come in out of orbit, and they ended up having to replace huge amounts of the shuttles every time. I don't know if it ended up being cost effective, but it's fantastic that they went in that direction. Hopefully they'll keep pushing it in that direction. Because that's obviously what we want to see, you know, in the future. You know, there's that news story about, it's Jim Cameron, I think it's Larry Page, and maybe Eric Schmidt from Google, and they're talking about mining asteroids, which sounds like a really phenomenal idea, launching, you know, basically robots onto asteroids that are passing and trying to bring back precious metals that are going to be, you know, hugely in abundance out there. It's awesome. It's great. It's going to further space travel. But it's not what I want to see. You know, as a Star Trek fan, I want to see people on a spaceship. I want to see families. You know, I want to see a 5-year mission. So the more we can be aiming in that direction, the happier I will be looking into the future.
Yeah, same here, too. And when I think about, you're talking about the reentry and how they learned what a beating the ship takes, and they have to replace so many of the tiles on the bottom of the shuttles when they come in. You know, to put this within context of the Star Trek history, this was basically research and development for Voyager, so that every time that Janeway wants to, you know, land the ship in the middle of a cyclone or, as we were just talking about on the Delta Quadrant here, the ship could take the beating. Now, do you know if the space shuttle, do they go to blue alert when they re-enter the atmosphere?
I don't know. I think that the whole alert system wasn't invented until everyone's favorite armory officer, Reed, in Enterprise. So I don't believe they've gotten to the alerts yet.
Right. The Reed alert.
The Reed alert,
as he originally considered naming it. That would have been
right.
That would have been cool.
Yes, and of course the other alerts were named after his ensigns, yellow and blue.
Oh,
Ensign Yellow, always getting into trouble.
Always. Ensign Green, always sick to his stomach. Always running down to talk to the doctor. All right, but I'm glad to see Enterprise getting a new home. And it kind of makes me sad to see the shuttle fleet being retired, because it's a turning point, you know, in our history of space exploration. But at the same time, I'm glad to see it, because we can finally take some of those resources and put them towards developing the next step and some ships that can actually take us somewhere. Because I would say that, can you imagine if in Star Trek they're on a planet and it takes them like 6 days to take off because the weather's bad?
Right.
So we have to come up with a little bit better solution than what we have right now.
Right. But yeah, it's kind of painful how much we're falling behind Star Trek history. You know, the Botany Bay was supposed to be launched, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
And that was during, like, a major world war.
Yeah, we didn't have any eugenics wars yet.
Yeah, like, where's our eugenics wars? I want my eugenics wars. Damn it.
I'm going to make you a t-shirt. All right, well, let's move on to the next thing here, Greg. This is just a quick update on the Destination Star Trek London. We have some news about pricing for autographs, and I think you'll be very excited. And I actually found the pricing breakdown to be a little bit interesting here.
Yeah, because you've got Shatner at the top, where a photo with Shatner costs £40. Pounds, that's what they use over in England, right?
Yes, pounds.
Okay, and then Patrick Stewart is £35. Scott Bakula coming in third with £30. And then Avery Brooks and Mulgrew are both £25 a piece. That's what it costs. That's not their weight. That's what it costs to take a picture with them. That's, so what I've seen on Twitter a bunch is people saying, wait. Bakula's worth more than Mulgrew? Than Brooks? Bakula? Really? So, what do you think of that, Chris?
I think it makes sense to me, because I think it's, of course, it's a Star Trek event, but you have to remember that Scott Bakula is probably more famous for Quantum Leap than he is for Enterprise. So if you put Quantum Leap and Enterprise together, you have an opportunity to get Scott Bakula's autograph, get your picture taken with him. I can see in there.
But Avery Brooks is also known as a crazy improvisational jazz piano musician. So shouldn't that raise his price at least like $1.50?
Maybe. So maybe you want to go with £26 and like a 50 pence, something like that.
Right. I want to know how much it costs to get a picture of Avery Brooks punching Q.
Oh, well, you can get that one. Or you can also get the one of him punching you. And it's really cool, actually, the way technology works now. They can embed this little chip into the photograph where he says, "I'm not Picard."
Exactly.
But he's punching you, so it makes it a little more personal moment for
right.
you.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty easy to get Brooks to punch you, though, you know. Just, you know, take a picture of him, stand too close, make fun of his piano playing.
I thought that was Chris Pine on the set of the new Star Trek movie.
Where is Chris Pine? I think Chris Pine could fetch at least, you know, 8 or 9 pounds.
Maybe. I want to know where Will Decker is on here.
And Alan Ruck. Yes, I think you can get Will Decker and Alan Ruck as a combo pack for at least 4 or 5 pounds.
Oh, I remember now, though. They're going to be over at the, what was it, Destination Star Trek Stratford-upon-Avon, is that right?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right.
And those prices are ranging from £2 up to £8, I believe.
Right. So it's good if you're on a budget.
Yes, it is. Now, you did mention that Shatner was at the top here, but Shatner is at the top of the list of captains, but there is one photo opportunity that's actually fetching £150, Greg, and that would be your most sought-after photo of you in the glamour.
Exactly. And I'm pretty sure that will be the longest line, even when they do raise it up to £150. So if you want to get your picture with the glamour, get to London early. Get to London often. Picture with the glamour is going fast.
Yeah. 150 of you and the glamour, or you can get the glamour to sit on your shoulders. That one's 200. Just that true physical contact. Now, you can also get one with Shatner sitting on your shoulders as well. But I have a feeling it's not going to be a very popular option.
Most likely not, Chris. So what else do we have in news today?
All right. So this is some news from Roddenberry Entertainment. And this is great news. Well, I got really excited when I first heard this. And this is that Trek Nation is going to be making its international premiere. I got very excited at first because I still haven't seen Trek Nation because so far it came on the Science Channel last November in the United States, and there has not been any other way for us to see it outside of the United States yet. So when I heard it was making its international premiere, I thought, oh, finally, this is my chance. But we're not quite there yet, because this actually has to do, once again, with London. And this is going to be the premiere at the 11th Annual Festival of Science Fiction and Fantastic Film in the Apollo Piccadilly Circus on May 7th.
Right. So a similar event to the one I went to last night at the Cinerama. They're having just a big science fiction fest, and they got Rod Roddenberry to come out and show Trek Nation, which I also haven't seen. Have we gotten any word? When is it going to show up on, you know, Netflix or Hulu or the iTunes?
I don't know yet. I would have thought that it would be available. If it were a normal TV show, I would have thought it would have been available on iTunes by now on the Science Channel's section. But I guess this is something that's more likely to be released on DVD, kind of like in the form of a movie, because basically it is a movie. So I don't know. I'm certain that it will be. When I talked to Rod a while back about Trek Nation, when he was with me on MatterStream, I asked him about DVD, and he felt that at some point there would be a DVD release, but in terms of a time frame, not really sure. So, but I think when that does come down the line, I'm hoping sometime this year we'll be able to get it everywhere. And so, like, for me in Japan, for those in other parts of Europe or anywhere else in the world, they will finally be able to see Trek Nation as well, because it just looks like a great, the clips I've seen look so wonderful. I just can't wait to see it.
Yeah. And definitely, you know, if you're in London, you know, head down to Piccadilly Circus and, you know, watch out for the clowns and the Ferris wheels and watch Trek Nation when it premieres on May 7th.
And we should add one more thing here, Greg. Besides Trek Nation, Roddenberry has another. It sounds very interesting. It is a 360-degree film that's been shot called White Room 02B3. And this is something that would be shown in a 360-degree dome theater. And this is also going to be making its international premiere at the festival in London at the same time as Trek Nation. And I don't really know a whole lot of details about that other than there's a quote from Trevor Roth, who is the chief operating officer for Roddenberry Entertainment. And he says that with White Room 02B3, we are certainly at the birth of a new kind of filmmaking. And I think it would be an interesting experience to see this and see if it maybe is leading us somewhere down the road. So say maybe, you know, I don't know, it could be like IMAX, which, you know, has been around forever, but hasn't really caught on as a filmmaking technique. Or this could be the future of filmmaking. So,
well, and you know, if you think about it as a step on the way to a holodeck, I think it makes a lot more sense, where you enter a room that is then going to become the room in which the film takes place. You're not looking through a window, you're stepping into the film. And that's a really great advancement. And it doesn't require, you know, a bulky headset like virtual reality would. It's just, you know, you want to look at what's happening to the left, you look to the left. You want to see to the right, and it's just there. And, of course, we needed to find out more about what this film actually is. But as a concept, the idea of stepping into a 360-degree film experience sounds really fantastic. And I can't wait until you know, we get some of those great holodeck programs done this way. You know, wouldn't you love to see Bride of Chaotica in 360-degree?
That would be pretty cool. Yeah, I have to agree with you. That would be quite nice to see this. So if you want more information on this, we have some on trek.fm. If you go to the Hypertunnel News Journal, you'll find it. And also if you go to roddenberry.com, you'll be able to find out more information, both about Trek Nation, of course, and about the White Room 02B3.
I hope you got fat. I hope you got really fat. 'Cause if you got really, really fat, you just might want to see me come back. I hope you got fat. Help me out now. Hey, I don't care.
All right, Greg. So apparently someone is getting fat as we move into movie news and rumors here.
Oh, so it's not William Shatner this time?
No, apparently not. Although he did put on a bit of weight for those films.
Yeah, I just saw Star Trek 2. My goodness, Bill, what happened to you there? But no, in this case, we're talking about future villain of Star Trek and current Sherlock star, Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, so some news came out. Finally, we got some tiny, tiny clues to who he might be playing. And he said, he was talking to London Net, and he said that he's gone up 2 suit sizes as he's really gotten into this role that he's playing.
Right. So here's my question now. Is he putting on fat or is he putting on muscle? Because I'm thinking if it's muscle, this is pretty much confirmation that he's going to be playing Khan. But if it's fat, I think we could be looking at Harry Mudd.
Or Henry Mudd.
Or Harvey Mudd, you know, any of the Mudd brothers.
Yeah, I love the Mudd brothers. I have them on a loop on my iPod as I commute every day.
Oh, yeah, their bluegrass band. Yeah. You know, Harry's fantastic on the spoons.
He is good. But the thing about when you go to a Mudd brothers concert is that you have to keep snorting this like a crystal stuff. And it's just not really into that. Too much.
Oh,
but,
man.
Oh, but so I don't know. To be honest, I don't know what this means. He said that the character I'm playing is strong. I can say that
right.
much. And I guess we kind of got that from the photos that leaked out a while back, but I don't.
Right. So, you know, and I'm glad to hear this. You know, it's good to have a big strapping villain to play against. You know, Tom Hardy, before he bulked up, just was not, he wasn't that intimidating as a villain in Star Trek Nemesis.
No, he wasn't very intimidating. And he also, you know, he wasn't a humorous villain either to play off of Picard's seriousness. So they could get, you know, get in some debates. And
That's
so we
true.
Didn't have that either. So maybe a muscular villain would be better, but I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it does sound like he could possibly be playing Khan here. I sure hope it's not Khan. I don't really want to see Khan.
Yeah, I don't know. But either way, I do hope that he gets into some good fist fights with Chris Pine.
Yeah, but you know, Chris Pine, I mean, even if it's not in the script, there's always that possibility from what I've heard.
Definitely.
Anyway, through some, you know, internet threads.
That's
and
pretty
so
true.
Forth.
I do hope if there's a fight scene in this one that Chris Pine's stunt double is a little less obvious than Shatner's stunt double from Space Seed. I don't know if you've seen the remastered Space Seed recently, but there's some shots where it's basically a close-up of Shatner's stunt double. It's like, wait, that's not him.
Well, there's one in is it Day of the Dove, I think, where they're wrestling around on the in the engineering room, I believe, and it's just so obviously not Shatner. It's like they made no effort of any kind to hide that. So
it's like they were assuming you were watching it on a TV, and at that moment, you know, you were readjusting the bunny ear antenna, and so the picture went fuzzy for a second. So it's okay.
It's okay. Just blame it on the rabbit ears.
Exactly.
All right. Well, one other thing that came out in here, Greg, that I found interesting was that Cumberbatch said that he dislikes the noise level inside the San Fernando Valley Budweiser brewery. So apparently engineering is still going to be set in a brewery.
I really thought that we'd heard, you know, last year that they decided that a brewery was just not, it didn't work. And I definitely agreed with that at the time. I'm wondering why they decided to go ahead and shoot in a, especially in a working factory.
I don't know. I mean, I can see from consistency standpoint that you're going to keep the same set, but there was so much complaint coming from the fans on that. And I'm pretty sure I remember from last year them saying they were going to build a new set, that I was a little bit surprised to hear that news. So we'll see. I mean, I guess there's going to be another Scotty in the tube scene or something like that.
Oh God. I mean, that aside, I'm hoping that they'll do something like, you know, CG set extensions or set deletions and try to make it look a little more Star Trek-y. I mean, I know JJ loves his realistic locations. You know, he loves to get in there with the camera. He doesn't like to be surrounded by blue screen. He doesn't even like sets that much. He wants it all to be super real. So I see why they would go back, but I thought this was a decision that they decided, you know, was a bad one.
Yeah, I thought so too, but well, apparently not. So we'll see. Another bit of news here. There are a couple of different stories here that are interesting when you combine them. Now, first of all, Chris Pine spoke out on Star Trek II, and he said it's relentless. And he also made a comment here that he said that we're almost done. It's wrapping up very soon. But yet there's another story where Leonard Nimoy said that he hinted anyway that he might be talking to J.J. Abrams about Prime Spock making another appearance in this movie. Now, how do you bring these two together, Greg? If they're almost done shooting and yet Nimoy may be talking to them about another appearance, how is that possible?
Well, okay, well, I was surprised, first of all, that they're wrapping up so soon, even though I know, again, JJ loves his short shoots. The faster you can get the bulk of the shooting in the can, the better off you're going to be, because that gives you more lead time to go back and do reshoots or add or delete scenes. So that's good to know that they're wrapping up the principal, but I guess that does leave them opportunities in the future. You know, if Nimoy is up to doing it, you know, maybe he could show up in a view screen like Janeway does in Nemesis.
Is he still going to be like on an icy planet though?
Right.
Or so maybe
shivering.
I think what it could be is, so you have Zachary Quinto Spock fighting against Cumberbatch, as we've seen those photos, and then Uhura comes out and she corners Cumberbatch with her phaser, and then this hand reaches from behind and does the neck pinch on Cumberbatch, and that's Prime Spock coming out from the shadows.
That's right. You know, they call that the double Spock.
That's the move.
Yes.
It's called the double Spock. Yeah. So whenever someone says that they double Spocked me, that's what it means. It's not like when someone double Rikers you, which is...
That's something completely different.
Something completely different.
I think we were talking about on the other side of the room.
Yes, we were. Okay, so last thing here, Greg, today in news. We've had a lot of photos leak out. Last show we talked about the photos that appear to show Spock descending into a volcano in an Iron Man suit. And now... there are yet more pictures that have come out. And I have to say, Greg, that I think these may be the most revealing photos yet. Have you seen these new shots that have come out?
I have. I've looked at them several times. I still have no idea what I'm looking at. Are you sure this is even from the Star Trek sequel?
I'm not sure. I think that someone may have been driving past a Home Depot. And, you know, it's spring. So people are going to be doing their gardens. People are going to be, you know, maybe planting some trees in their front yard.
Right.
I don't know. This is just like a bunch of red tips or something here out in the parking lot. You know, at Home Depot, they like take over like a quarter of the parking lot this time of year, and they put all the trees out. I think that's what this is.
Very possibly. I'm sure. We'll get to the film. This will be a vital part of a larger planetscape. But right now, it looks kind of silly. If you haven't seen the pictures, you know, head on over to Trek Movie and look at them. They definitely, I don't think they look like real plants. They do look like alien plants of some sort. And I'm sure someone in the art department worked extremely hard on them. So let's not be too hard on them.
Well, let's remember that in Star Trek V, they painted the horses blue, which is why they didn't have any money left for the rock people at the end. And in Insurrection, I believe it is. Not Insurrection, actually. I think it was at Aaron of Mercy, or was it Insurrection where they painted the llamas? Maybe that was Insurrection, I think. They painted the llamas.
Aaron of Mercy, they did too. There's a lot of animal spray painting. Yeah.
Yes, there is. Aaron of Mercy, they painted the goats green, I believe
that's
it was.
It.
So these are probably just regular shrubs and they just spray painted them red. It's no telling how much of the budget went to paint for this.
I just imagine the production meeting and it's getting into like, you know, the wee hours, like 2:30, 3 a.m. And JJ's just like, just paint them red. I don't care. Just paint them red. And well, now here we are.
So Spock is usually very calm and cool and collected, but every 7 years, Vulcans get what shall we say, for lack of a better word, they get a little bit horny and they need to go back to their home world, to the Vulcan planet. And that's what happens in the classic TOS episode, Amok Time. And this week we're going to talk about Amok Time. And of course, Greg is here and joining us this week. We have the creator of Riker's ship, the USS Titan, Sean
Hello.
Taranjo.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, Sean. And also we have with us Mr. Whoopi Goldberg himself, Michael Fisher.
Nice to see you gentlemen again. And Sean, great to share a show with you. This is excellent.
All right. Well, we're glad to have you guys with us. And so let's think a little bit about Amok Time. And of course, none of us were around to see this in first run, so we've all seen it on, in my case, regular TV, a good old-fashioned wooden television set, or on DVD. So, Michael, why don't you lead us in here and tell us about what do you take away from Amok Time?
Amok Time is the of course, the default episode to think of whenever someone mentions or hums or references the Star Trek fight music, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is, the music, this track has just been endlessly repeated. It's kind of as pop culture valid as the communicator, I feel like, right? And so to fire up this episode is to kind of anticipate that the whole time. And but you know, it's a lot more than that, obviously. But it's the season opener of season two. It's the first time we see Chekhov. It's the first time we see. It was one of the only times we see Spock lose it. I mean, it's so much, and it's so very, very Star Trek. You know, it's a brilliant classic original series episode that kind of embodies a lot of what the series can do best. So that's what it is to me right now.
How about you, Sean?
Well, it's the first time, first time you see Spock lose it. It's also the first time you get to see Spock's homeworld, and you get to see a little bit more of his culture and a little bit more of the mythos behind what makes a Vulcan a Vulcan. And also a little bit of a love triangle, of course, with Stahn and T'Pring and all that.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. All right.
No, that's the friendship actually gets a... first time you really see, it's mentioned many times, he's your friend between Spock, McCoy, right. And Kirk. So, and as we were talking before, you also get to see the monkey of the Star Trek mythos, Chekhov.
Most hair on that whole bridge.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it would have walked off like a tribble if it could.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really impressed, you know, rewatching this episode, how good it is, you know, just as an episode. I was talking at dinner last night about how, you know, some TOS episodes are good because they're, you know, goofy and fun, and some are good because they're actually good, like they're quality stories and quality acting. And this is one of those ones that just hits it on all cylinders. It starts with a mystery, it moves into sort of an adventure, and then has this great fight scene to wrap it up with a twist ending. You know, it hits all those points. And I really have a hard time finding anything to dislike about Amok Time.
It's also, I found, just remembering back, it's the first time you see Spock sort of do something out of the ordinary. He fakes orders to get to the planet. He'll do anything to get back home. Yeah. You know, just like, okay, we're going. And the twist at the end, you take whatever time you need to do from the Admiralty. He goes, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's interesting when Spock is confronted about, you know, when Kirk confronts Spock about, you defied my orders, you changed the ship's course, and Spock is kind of like, did I? And Kirk's like, yeah, you're denying it? And Spock's like, no, it's very possible. I'm kind of crazy. And it's like, what is going on? And that point in the episode, like, I was tense. I was sitting on my couch because they just do that build where Kirk orders him to sickbay and Spock's just kind of wandering the corridors, making the decision to go, and maybe he's going to go, or maybe he's just going to shoot somebody. I mean, we saw what he did to Christine Chapel in her soup.
Duck and cover.
Yeah. Well, one thing, I mean, you talk about, see Spock doing something out of the ordinary. This is an episode that kind of relies on you having seen the show before. And it sort of builds off of the understanding of who the Spock character is and of that Spock-Kirk-McCoy dynamic and everything that was built up in the first season. You know, you don't really think of TOS as being the bastion of continuity, but here you are. You know, the only reason that Spock acting with emotions is shocking is because you know who Spock is, and he has been established as being complete without emotion.
You know, and that works really well here, too, because one thing about this episode that I like, when you think about later series, like Voyager, for example, where you'll have teasers that are like Janeway on the holodeck, talking to Leonardo da Vinci. It has like, what the hell's going on? I love in Amok Time that they just go straight into the story. You know, they come down, McCoy comes down the corridor, and you're right into the story. And like you said, Greg, it works really well because at this by now we know who Spock is. And so the reaction, there's no explanation is needed as to what's going on. McCoy just says, you know, he told me that what's the exact line, you know, but he's very strong worded against McCoy, and he hasn't been eating, and you know it's unusual. And then when you see him, Chapel come running out of the room and he throws soup, you know, like something crazy's going
it's
on.
It's the first time he actually goes, I want to leave I have a leave of absence coming up. I want to take it planet side. And it's actually he doesn't say it all in his very monotone way. He gets that angry, like, I will go.
Right. Mm-hmm. I've given you my request. Now, what is your answer? Yeah.
All you have to do is answer it.
Don't wait for the translation. Right. Answer me now.
Answer me now.
Pans to Kirk with that light going across his eyes.
The Kirk eye light was strong in this episode, wasn't it? We had like five or six Kirk close-ups.
And Kirk looks so boyish in this episode, too, doesn't he? Yeah. When they do those close-ups, the look on his face, especially right after this, when he takes, I guess it's after the... changes course, but when he go in and they talk to, he talks to Spock about the reason why Spock is in this condition, and they start talking about biology, and doesn't Kirk look so uncomfortable?
Yeah,
he has a little smirk on his face.
He doesn't want to have to talk about with his command crew.
Yeah,
right.
Especially about Spock. Yeah. I might not want to know about the birds and the bees on your planet. I have enough women to go after.
it's amazing, and that's of course the counterpoint, right? I mean, Kirk is so uncomfortable talking about this, but it's like, why, man? Like every single port, you know, Captain Kirk is either forced into sex to do something for the crew, or just does it, of his own accord. And he's like, in this situation, he's talking to his best friend, which is kind of interesting. And he's like, no, there's nothing to be ashamed of.
I don't have a reason to rip my shirt off. Why? you'll have something.
I think that's when he makes
the
choice. I was just gonna say, he's like, man, I'm gonna stick my chest right out there and get that blade.
And I love Spock's the delivery that Leonard Nimoy gives of the line when he says, "The birds and the bees are not Vulcan."
Are not Vulcan.
Yes, it's a fantastic line.
And of course, this brings us. You talk about the place, importance of this episode, and even that scene within the greater Star Trek history. As Greg pointed out to me in the other side of the room, this is the source of the title of Leonard Nimoy's famous book. Right, Greg? I Am Not a Fish.
Right, exactly. I am not.
And then his follow-up years later, I Am a Fish.
Right.
If this, when you're saying that, I'm just thinking of a line from Next Generation with Worf, I am not a merry man.
I am not a merry man.
That's
you
right.
You get all those iconic one-liners.
instead of smashing a ukulele here, Spock can just smash a view screen.
Which, by the way, I did not know that that was coming up. I did not remember that that was from this episode.
I also
forgot
that.
There's one of my favorite animated GIFs like of all time is that like 5 second thing where Spock crosses the room, leave me alone, and he does a 3-fist smash into that computer, and man, it's. That's right up there with Khan bending a phaser in half for, like, 60s Play-Doh special effects. It's like, oh, it's awesome.
All it was missing was some smarts.
They actually showed that.
I know.
I mean, they showed that in the last, Transformers film. Like, the robots are watching it on TV. Like, oh, this is the one where Spock goes crazy.
Yes.
But I totally did not remember that it was a Mock Time that he does it. And it's like, whoa, that's...
Yeah.
Going from playing the little harp to smashing a view screen.
Wouldn't want to mess with Spock in that state, and this is when we get. Can someone tell me? I'm foolish. I didn't do the research on this. Can someone tell me if this is the first time that we hear the fight music? Because it's in this scene, in this episode. This is the first time we hear the fight music.
It's iconic.
And
it's for this show.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the stuff that's going on with Doomsday Machine and stuff like that. They replayed a lot of that music in the background for other. Other episodes, but for this fight scene, that was the first time I think it was actually used.
Okay.
Yeah, but they go on to use
many
it.
Times.
It wasn't heard in the first season at all.
Oh, it wasn't.
It was just,
okay, so then it is unique to this episode. Well, then it's great because we hear it before we hear it. Like, we hear it in this scene, and it's at, 1/8 speed or something like that.
Yeah.
And so, they're having this discussion, and Kirk's getting uncomfortable, and it's just in the background. It's amazing. And I picked up on it pretty quickly, and it was like, I was like, whoa, this is the thing.
There's a little bit of bolero feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
actually, season 2 is when
Spock
they started
getting for this episode.
Well,
that gets reused a lot in future episodes.
Yeah, season 2 is actually when they started getting a lot, their soundtrack got a lot more episodic, and they actually recognized you can start telling which episode it was from. Just being my little soundtrack geek in me.
It's very, very cool. I mean, there's a lot of firsts for this episode. I mean, you talk about I'm Not a Fish, but this is the first time we hear Live Long and Prosper. This is the first time we see the Vulcan hand
salute. And isn't it one of the first time we saw the Idic pin? Because they had the Idic in the background on some of the people, I thought. Or was that?
Was it in the?
It might have been.
Is it in this episode? I didn't notice it, but you could be correct.
Because I know Itik is later when Mark Leonard gets put when Sarek is introduced, because you see that in there.
Right.
But I thought I saw it in the background on some of the fixings in the backdrops.
Hmm. Oh. Oh, cool.
Maybe I was too distracted by the giant bell racks.
Yeah.
I thought maybe you were distracted by the fact that all the background Vulcans were wearing the Romulan helmets.
Well, that's kind of cool that later on they sort of it ties in that the Romulans and the Vulcans come from a common ancestry. Yeah. So that's
maybe they would have figured it out sooner if they'd realized that they both bought helmets from the same manufacturer.
That's right. Well, let's check these invoices here. Let's see. Right. Yeah. You know,
your helmet's gold, but mine's
silver.
That's
why silver. There's so much animosity there. Yeah, it's like, because they got, the Romulans got a better price.
You call them up. Yeah. We ordered gold helmets. You sent us silver. Oh, sorry. Those were for those other guys with the pointy ears.
Yeah. We'll give you a price.
No, sorry here.
But yeah, it's a good point that this is one of the, we often talk about, Greg and I talk about on here anyway, that Enterprise is the series that really truly develops the Vulcan culture. We really, really learn so much about the Vulcans in Enterprise. And in the original series, although Spock as a character is so famous and therefore Vulcans are very famous, we don't really learn all that much about Vulcan culture in the original series. But again, Amok Time is the first time we really get to see it, and it's really also the primary time that we get to see at least the Vulcan.
And especially
Vulcan
when they introduced
planet.
T'Pau. When they introduced T'Pau, he goes, she's the only person who did not take a seat on the Federation Council. She has such a long history. And so that sort of did a perfect setup for when she was later shown on Enterprise. So you get to see they left her enough mystery. But it was nice to see them round her out in that the tail end of the Enterprise series. So you get to sort of put two and two together and say, oh, so this is why she's more stoic toward on my time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you think about it, how much T'Pau saw, I mean, she was around before the discovery of the Kirshara, and now she's seen all the way into past the Romulan War. She's seen the birth of the Federation.
She's there before
all
her first
of
contact.
The stuff that T'Pau's seen. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, she's, one of the, probably the oldest Vulcan we ever see. Mm-hmm. She's older than Sarek was when he died.
Well, Kirk actually makes a comment in this episode about T'Pau that she basically is Vulcan.
Yeah.
In a sense, like, she represents...
Oh, right.
Everything that is Vulcan.
Which is provides, of course, wonderful justification for Kirk to say yes to the challenge, for Kirk to accept the challenge and, not have to...
And I like how she gave him an out. Because since you are not of our way, you have the right to say no. And he says, no, he's my friend. I will do whatever it takes.
But do you
and
think...
Then it's only...
Do you think that maybe, though, that Kirk was looking over there at T'Pring and thinking, like, well, if I could win this, there's T'Pring right over there. So,
yeah. Well, can we talk about T'Pring for a moment? She is probably the worst person ever. that whole speech she gave to Spock. If Kirk won, I would have Staan. If you won, I would have Staan. If Nero came and blew up Vulcan, I would have Staan.
That's true, yeah.
Yes,
I mean,
all roads kudos. Lead to Staan.
That's why I would kind of hope
engineered it real well, man. I can't begrudge her that. I mean,
I would love
Spock
to see
something
like that logical. Happen in the JJ verse, because now you got Uhura who would be stepping up for Kirk, and she's like, "No, you're not going to fight Staan. I'm going to fight you." So you'd have a girl fight for Spock.
Oh, that'd be it's sort of like. What was it? Code of Honor with that terrible mace fight.
Oh,
but
in
this time, it would be awesome.
No,
it would just be
vaccine.
Uhura doing like head.
And so basically, if Uhura wins, that means that T'Pring gets Uhura, right?
No, Uhura gets Spock and Staan.
Whoa.
There you go.
This just turned into a different podcast.
Either way, Staan's someone is.
Yeah, I was going to say, Staan is just the winner in this whole
Staan's
thing.
Staan's like this, hello.
Staan's like, I'm okay with this any way it turns out.
Right. That's why Staan never says anything. He just stands there. He's like,
He just stands there and holds his
awesome.
He must be like you know, inheriting a fortune or, you know, head of some corporation. I don't know, because he's so passive, but apparently he is, you know, Dupring's, you know, dream guy.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's so great is after Dupring's, like, you know, logic bomb where she's like, this, and this. I mean, no matter what, I was going to get Stan, and, you know, just kind of like this, as close as a Vulcan can get to smugness, where she's totally logical, and even Spock acknowledges that. And it's one of my favorite Spock moments, where he gets to just drop this sick burn on her, and on them. He's like, yeah, you can have her, Stan, because she's way logical, but having is not so pleasing a thing as wanting.
Yeah.
Just letting you know that is sometimes true. And then he's like, you know, fires up his communicator. He's like, I got to get out of here.
Yeah,
and
it's he just raises awesome. That one eyebrow.
Yeah. And he's just like, yeah, enjoy. I hope she doesn't burn you like she just burned me, sucker.
Good luck. Wait,
enjoy the next 250 years.
Yeah. Yeah, give me a call at the next Pon Farr. Tell me how it's going.
No, he's like, give me a call at the next Pon Farr. I want a piece of that action. This was fun. I like this ceremony.
Oh, man.
It's exciting.
Right.
Yeah, the fact that Kirk can barely breathe and they have to give him supposed triox.
Right. Triox.
Right. Air quotes.
Yeah,
that's okay. Sneaky in so itself, what McCoy does. He's like, there's no way you're going to win. I'm going to fix it. Yeah, yeah.
I liked there that McCoy did it, but he didn't tell Kirk because... Yeah. In the later series, you know, like if it were Dr. Crusher, she would tell Picard. Yeah. So, okay, well, I'm going to give you this, and it's going to make you pass out. Now, act like you don't know what's going on.
But that's the thing is, with Kirk's machismo, if he knew something was put in there, he would.
Yeah.
He wouldn't act the same. So he needs to think that he has total control and that he's doing all he can to try to beat Spock. And the fact that McCoy had that up his sleeve is just... It's nice.
You get that a little in the JJ movie too, where McCoy just jabs Kirk and gives him the
jabs him
to make
stuff.
Him sick. It doesn't tell him ahead of time.
It's like
just
It's like, how long does this take? Passes out.
Yeah.
you might get some itching. You might get some. Oh, you have some swollen tongue? Oh no.
We got numb tongue. I can fix that.
Yeah.
You keep jabbing.
Am I supposed
everything.
To be doing this? Would you knock that off?
Oh my god. I can fix that. But what
now? Yeah. Yeah. Do you think T'Pau ever like brought this up to Spock, you know, when she's, you know, later reading, you know, the Vulcan Times and sees that Kirk isn't actually dead? Did she ever bring this up to Spock? Like, you really, you know, you're supposed to not do that. You realize this is a whole Vulcan honor code thing.
Yeah, but then he could say,
you know, centuries of like ancestors.
He could say, well, I didn't know. I mean, it was all McCoy.
That's true.
For all I knew, he was dead. And
that's
it's
a good point.
And it settled his blood fever.
Right.
So.
Right. Which did anyone know before? It sounded like no one knew that fighting would get rid of the blood fever before this. And then later on in Voyager, we find out that you just have to sort of do a little fist fight for a couple minutes. I'm starting to think they need to realize all you have to do is like get really steamed for about 30 seconds, and it just passes.
Right.
Like it's not a
you
big deal,
you just fire
guys.
Up Worf's calisthenics program in the holodeck and be cured of the Pon Farr in like 40 seconds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Leave Spock in a room with a Vulcan for about with a Klingon for about 10 minutes and see what happens.
Right.
Walks out with a Bat'leth. And next.
Or if it's like, if Tuvok's going through it, you just put him in a room with Neelix for like 10 seconds.
Not even 10.
Oh, wow. Curious.
Just walking in the room with Neelix. I'm done.
Hello, Mr. Vulcan. Yeah.
I can imagine on the Enterprise, Riker's like volunteering. Like, look, if anyone has Pon Farr on the ship, just give me a call. I can take care of that.
And there's Troy. Yeah. Imzadi, what about me? No. Look at this Vulcan over here.
He's like, well, Troy, if you want to Deanna, you know, if you want to pretend you have Pon Farr, then I can do that.
We'll do
too.
A little role play later when we're on the Titan.
I got a program for that.
If you can pretend as well as Dr. Salar pretends, it does it realistically, then
there you go.
So you just have to fight a little bit. You have to, you know, break a gong.
Watch out a few interesting. The blade weapons were nice. The two.
I like how easily they break off.
Yeah.
I was gonna say everything on Vulcan is like radiation embrittled or something. Like it's just nothing can stay together.
Well, it also shows that how much farther the Vulcans are a little bit stronger than the humans.
Yeah.
Kirk can't break it. Kirk couldn't break it, but Spock can break it easily.
It's true,
a good point.
But wouldn't you think that the Vulcans would make everything stronger? If they are stronger, wouldn't they make their gongs stronger? I would think so.
It's a good point.
Well, it is 60s TV series at its best, so got to throw something falling apart. And it breaks right down the middle of a diagonal line.
Yeah, not to mention the mysteriously exploding bonfire for no reason.
Yeah.
Did you guys catch that?
Right.
Like in that tension building sequence, and all of a sudden this just like flare emanates from the hot coals. And it's like, all right, does somebody drop a battery in there or what?
If this episode were done today with all the product placement, that would be like a Dr. Scholl's thing where they have to like walk across those coals.
Yeah.
As part of the fight.
You'd have a Vulcan up in the background holding a Dr. Pepper. Smiling. Oh yes, I'm not supposed to smile.
And he's like really hammy. He's holding it and he's pointing and he's got a I'm a pepper.
You'd have Chapel at the beginning. And this is brought to you by Plummix Soup.
Yes. That's right. New
Campbell's.
New from Campbell's.
Plummix.
No one makes Plummix Soup like Campbell's.
Like Campbell's. Yes. Eat your Campbell's chunky soup.
So we talk about Kirk, Spock, and McCoy a little bit here. They are the great triumvirate of Star Trek, the three of them together. And in the original series, we do get to see them a bit. Now, we've talked on here before about how in the movies, they always split them up. And Star Trek V is like the only moment.
The only time they sit down around the campfires.
You get to see them reminiscing. Yeah, here you do get to see them together, and it is a great character building episode for the three of them. And as you said, in the other side of the room, how they get together and they are basically they're like fist bumping each other. Like, yeah, we friends, man, we friends. And
I mean, McCoy and Spock are supposed to have this sort of bickering relationship. But in this episode, they are total, they're absolutely bromancing up one wall and down the other. It's really cool.
They are, but McCoy does seem a little bit surprised in the turbo lift when Spock says, I also want McCoy to come with me down to the planet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's a case where you see Spock actually acknowledging that he kind of revels in the arguments that he has with McCoy. It's sort of like he won't ever say that they're intellectually equal. But when it comes to the tit for tat that they go back and forth, I almost see Kirk saying, okay, how can I rally them up this time? See, just so I can see another, who's going to win this verbal sparring?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, it's like, Wrath of Khan, Spock gives Kirk the Tale of Two Cities. Yeah. And Kirk says, is there some hidden message behind this? And Spock says, none that I'm conscious of. Yeah. And he always has this, yes, he knows exactly what he's doing. He loves it, and that somewhere in the back of his mind, he loves McCoy, and he loves every moment that he's arguing with him. Mm. But he puts up that front. And I think if you were just a casual viewer of the series, you wouldn't realize that. You'd think, oh, those guys just hate each other. But come to a mock time, and like you said, that moment in the turbo lift, you finally know Spock loves
him. And that sort of goes down to the end of Wrath of Khan also. He could have picked Scotty for the Katra. But he's pulled McCoy. Yep. Like, I don't have time to explain this here. Yeah, I trust you with my soul. And so that's sort of, to me, that's sort of the ultimate trust. He couldn't get to Kirk, so he gets to the next his next best friend that he could, even though they have the sparring over the years, that he actually trusts and relies on the relationship that he has with McCoy and also with Kirk.
Yeah.
And Kirk reciprocates that in probably the most significant way that he can for Kirk, where he has having the discussion with McCoy, and he gets the no from the Admiral Komak, and Kirk's like, well, we're going to Vulcan anyway,
right?
And and he just basically says it's not even a long thing. He doesn't even take a moment to decide it. He's just like, Spock's my friend. I owe my life 100 times over.
Yeah, he saved me how many times? I can do this for him.
Yeah,
and I still owe him.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, it's that moment in Battlestar Galactica where the who is it? The Chief and Anders, and it's just like you see Kirk make that same decision.
He doesn't have to think twice.
You don't want to. You want to follow rules, but you get to a point where no, I'm the sort of guy who doesn't just bow down under pressure.
So say we all.
So say we all.
I'm going to go out and do it. And it's great to see Kirk doing that because it's so easy to make fun of, really easy to make fun of Shatner. Yeah. And it's really easy to pull Kirk into that and think, he's just a ladies' man. He's always taking his shirt off. He's always getting into fist fights. But he really is a great commander. And it comes down to which captain would you want to serve under? Mm-hmm. And this is one of those episodes where, well, especially if I'm Kirk's best friend, I want to serve under Kirk because he really cares and he's going to do everything he can. You know, Federation rules be damned.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also like his way of throwing the prime directive to the wind. If it's got means saving somebody, a planet, or saving some of his crew, the hell with the prime directive. I'm going to go get him back to the ship. I'd rather have the guy survive and I'll face it, be damned the consequences. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kirk might put you in more danger and likely almost get you killed more often than Picard would, but at least you know that Kirk is going to go to the ends of the universe to save you.
Well, the only other captain that was like that, in my opinion, is Sisko. Because Sisko, it's like, okay, you're in danger. I'm going to go down and take you out. Make sure you come back. And he's just the only other captain that would actually go fisticuff to fisticuff with somebody to save a crew member.
I don't know, man. Picard went back into Borg-infested engineering to go get Data back. That takes some stones that I might not have. I'll tell you that. Don't be friends with me if the Borg are around.
That's true.
I'll see you later.
Later seasons Picard, film Picard for sure, had that. But Kirk had that all the way back.
Yeah.
Even in season 2.
Yeah.
Well, it's like it goes back.
And some of the other captains never quite found it.
It goes back with Kirk all the way to the pilot, where how much he was willing to do with Mitchell. Mitchell's going nuts and he's killing everybody. He still wants to save him, even if it's the cost of his life. And that showed to me from the pilot on with Kirk, it showed the kind of person he was. Yes, he's a ladies' man. But if you're his friend and you're there for him, he's going to be there for you 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about the next part of the show, which we hit on a little bit, but I call it the hey, it's the monkeys part of A Mock Time. It's a great moment for me when that reveal when Kirk asks how long will it take us to get there, and they cut over and you see that hair for the first time. And
that is some magical stuff. There's a lot of Brill Cream or something in that. You see the stage lights just shining off it. It's incredible.
And I also like how on The Next Generation, so Picard might ask Data, how long will it take us to get to Vulcan if we can be there and not miss the conference? And Data will say something like, if we fly at warp 6.23 for 4.71 hours. And here, Chekhov's like, he's got like a pencil and paper or something on the dash there.
Just figuring it out on the fly. Yeah, carry the two. It'll be there 2 days.
Let's see. Carry the two. about warp 6, Captain. Warp 6,
And if we go around the nebula, we can be there at, use warp 7 maybe.
I like that, especially because, I mean, it reinforces this kind of very, very 1960s thing of the Enterprise is a naval, a naval cruiser of some kind with a navigator who's, working some complicated, abacus stuff and slide rule action, and he's a steely-eyed missile man who's got to figure out, plotting courses and stuff like that. It's very, very, very rocket age, very nostalgic in the best kind of way if you're kind of a NASA lover and a lover of that period,
I don't have an awful lot to say about Chekhov. I like the whole comedic relief aside from him, but I don't think he had the intended effect that they were hoping with the whole ladies' man dynamic.
Well, he did have the Davy. He did, for all the worse, he did have that Davy Jones look. But
yes, that was the goal, I think.
Yeah, but they only really played that up in like 2 or 3 episodes with him.
Yeah.
And other than that, they just sort of had him in there being the young guy trying to learn something. And the only time they really sort of played the Davy Jones stuff is when he had all the space hippies in there with one of his friends from school. With looking for Eden. And then the other one where they were stuck on the gunfighter planet. Where they had be the OK Corral.
Spectre of the gun.
Right.
But it's just sort of, other than that, it's just like he had his little line of thing. It's the original Russian, or how he'd play up on his Russian heritage. That's ridiculous. I always got a kick accent out of that. So
yeah,
right. I did think there was a missed opportunity in this episode for Chekhov, though. I think they should have taken Chekhov down to act as an interpreter for T'Pau.
She does come across a bit like an Indiana Jones villain.
Some kind of
Captain
weirdo
Kirk, you
vampire.
Have 5 minutes to bring me the artifact.
Thy have 5 minutes to bring me the artifact. Thee can refuse if thee wishes. It's like, what is? I feel like I'm listening to drunk Shakespeare. What the hell is going on with the Vulcan language?
Yeah, that would be a great podcast.
There must have been something wrong with the Universal Translator. It was like, she's talking something weird. I don't know.
The Universal Translator is stuck right up there with this. Maybe
that's why. That's what Stein had that expression on his face the whole time.
Universal Translator's been shoved somewhere where it hasn't needed to be.
So that's Chekhov in here, but it's just interesting seeing him in here.
It was great to see him to see his first appearance.
Yeah, it's the way they introduce a character.
Pop up and it's like,
so. Well, and then that time he's like, is that just going to be the rotating character that sits at that console, like it was in the first season?
Yeah, because you didn't.
No one knew that would be at that point that would be a mainstay. So
right,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. But it gives Sulu someone to talk to as well, you know, and it establishes the great B plot of this episode, which is Sulu and Chekhov just changing course back and forth and talking about it.
Right. Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, it's also...
Yeah, he just has two speed keys set up. One of them goes to the conference, one of them goes back to Vulcan.
Yeah.
Well, it's also it's the first time you actually get to see Sulu or someone else besides the Kirk, McCoy, and Spock actually start having relationships.
Right.
And
you see
Sulu taking the young ensign sort of under his wing and sort of showing him the ropes. And that sort of, especially when you got later into the movie, you just sort of see the camaraderie. You see just by, they would, you know, they've been through it. So they sort of look at each other and sort of have that look, that sort of smirk. Okay, what's Kirk going to pull out of his ass this time? Kind of look.
Right. A universal translator.
Right. Yes.
Nice.
Which thankfully is not a Babel fish.
Yeah.
Or an Aldebaran shell mouth.
Oh,
which
no.
I really need to know what the hell the McCoy, is that ever referenced again?
I doubt it. Yeah,
I don't know. What other threads do we have in this episode? We have the little thread of Nurse Chapel kind of pining over Spock a little bit.
Majel Barrett does such a wonderful job of being the kind of
the starry-eyed
of embodying that unrequited love.
Yeah.
That magical tear that kind of leaks out there. Christine.
Yeah, I'm almost glad to see her as Nurse Chapel instead of number one, because she was just this sort of frowny face first officer. But here she gets to really play up the sort of character she ends up becoming as Lwaxana.
Mm.
And now she was able to do the sort of grim-faced as the computer voice. So we got both sides of Major.
Well, unfortunately, because you only got to see one episode with her as number one, and it would have been, if they would have gone with Pike's crew, you would have seen her probably loosen up and all that stuff. And so unfortunately, you didn't get to see what that character would have been like. But Majel was just...
I mean, once she grew the beard in season three, it just...
It all would have taken right off.
But she's just... The fact that they kept her such an integral part of the crew, even though she wasn't a main character. It was good to see sort of... she kept McCoy in check, especially in the sick bay. Because when he was having one of his little fits about everything, she would come walking in and sort of calm him down. And it's sort of... I love the... When it goes to the motion picture, you have... right after McCoy gets shanghaied back onto the ship... And he's like, well, I hear she's a doctor now. Well, give me a good head nurse. I don't want to be arguing with her.
That was fantastic.
Yep.
Just the fact that she can, she knows what she's doing and she knows how to keep McCoy in check.
And we hear in the Abramsverse film, we hear Nurse Chapel like paged or, or McCoy
asked
for her or something. I really hope we get to, I hope we really get to see her in the next film. See how she's reimagined. Cause she is a really fantastic character. And I think the original series didn't really have time for her because there's so much with Kirk McCoy, yeah. Spock.
Yeah.
They never really went to Nurse Chapel except in like this episode where she sort of gets a B or a C story.
Well, if they would have continued it all the way through the first of the five seasons, I think you would have seen more of her.
Yeah, probably.
And unfortunately, then with the animated series, you got to see a little bit of her. But also, if you would have gone with seasons 4 and 5, that way you'd also would have seen. Unfortunately, wouldn't have had the technology, but you would have had a couple other people like A-Rex and M-Res show up. So you have those other characters. But I think they with Chapel, she had enough of a character built up that they could actually use her more. That would have been, especially if she was studying. If they would have played that the fact that she's studying to be a doctor, you would have had her maybe doing more, going on more away missions, maybe, and getting more time.
That all comes from Gene Kuhn's magic bag of hindsight, right?
Yeah.
right. I do like how McCoy, as her like division head and you know boss in sick bay and whatever, is totally hip to the fact that she's pining for Spock and is like doesn't even really give her a hard time about it. He's like, Vulcan soup. Yeah, I see what you're doing there. And then she's like, no, well, it's not. He's like, yeah, I get it. No, go for it.
Just go ahead.
Go for it.
It's such a cool, like, you know, workplace environment, it seems like. It's like, I understand you, and you are hopeless, but, you know, go for it.
He will never feel for you, but hey, go ahead. Have fun.
But, you know, hey, it's all right. Yeah.
McCoy's probably telling her, he's like, well, nurse, you know, I could mix something up for you if you want.
Just
put a couple of drops in that soup and he'll be all yours.
I can do some surgical. Vulcan. I can give you some pointed ears if that'll help.
I can give you this. I'll suppress your personality.
Yeah.
Just go in his quarters and do some math. You'll be right in the pants in no time.
Now, I think if we go back down to the planet for a minute, I remember, Greg, you mentioned before we started recording here that you thought that T'Pring was very hot. And I think that we can all get behind you on that. But but you also thought T'Pau was quite hot, right?
No, I was saying T'Pau from Enterprise was hot. Right.
One and the same, buddy. In for a penny, in for a pound.
Yeah, I don't know. Vulcans, you know, hold on to their looks for quite a long time.
Over 200 years. Yeah,
I don't quite understand why Sarek went for the female, the human women.
It was logical.
Because they keep. Yeah.
He tried that with Cybok's mother and said, nah, too much trouble.
Right.
I'm going to go to Earth.
There you go.
They may be infuriating and illogical, but at least I can get a word in edgewise.
it's really interesting to see like how really incredibly paternalistic like ancient Vulcan society is. Like it's, you know, it's like T'Pring, you will be the property of the champion. Are you prepared to be the property of the champion? It's like how does this coexist with a society where like one of the most important people on the planet is also a woman? Like I don't understand this dynamic very well. And I guess it's sort of explained away by the fact that it's like, this is an ancient thing. It's how it was back in the beginning. So,
and the still fact that goes back to the fact matter. You win, I still have Ston. He wins, I have Ston.
Right. No, true enough. Yeah, the ladies have a lot more control than they're maybe admitting.
Yeah, at least it's not like...
Yeah, I think that's probably
maybe
what
it's
it
not
is.
Like, maybe it's like the Denobulans, how many extra wives you can have.
Right.
And how many husbands.
Well, I think, you know, if you look at it seriously, this is a part of their society that they don't examine too closely because they're kind of screwed up and they're afraid of this aspect of themselves.
True.
So I think they've sort of created this ritual and it works and they're leaving it alone, even as...
It's the first time you see humans actually see this, at least as far as we know. First time you get to see humans get to see this side of the Vulcan, civilization. They may have in the past with like with Trip or something like that, but who knows? but for the viewers, it's the first time you actually see Vulcan culture besides being on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, this is definitely a very important episode within the greater Star Trek universe, the storyline of Spock. I think it really set, I mean, there are a lot of great episodes in the first season as well. But this is definitely one of the true standouts, not only of the second season, but of the whole series. And it is one of the ones that I go back and watch from time to time as well. And not just so I can see Spock smash a view screen.
Well, at the end, it also, I like how Spock takes responsibility. He goes, I've killed my friend.
Yeah.
Not knowing that Kirk's alive. He goes, I've killed my friend. I must now go turn myself in. I've done what I had to do for myself, but now I must face the music and go back and relinquish command and turn myself into the authorities. And that's sort of, it shows you that, yes, he's torn apart, but he's also, he's going to do the right thing. Instead of just like, hey, I'm going to stay here, and no matter what happens, I killed someone, I'm going to stay here.
Definitely. Yeah, that does lead us to a final point here, which is when they do get back to the ship, and he does find out that Kirk is still alive, and we see that outburst from him.
Yeah.
Jim!
Yeah, and it's one of those signs early on, you know, even before Voyager and Enterprise, that the Vulcans do have emotions, that they are... It's not a complete retcon. They have emotions that they're keeping deep down inside.
Mm-hmm. And that also shows that the fact that Spock has a little bit more trouble because he has that half human in him. And that shows also the turmoil that he's always trying to keep it in check and not, he's like, okay, I got to keep this really, not show any emotion, but hey, you're alive.
Right. And on the flip side, like earlier in the episode, when he is so violently conflicted, I mean, there's a point right at the beginning of the episode where he's talking to Kirk and he's holding that stylus behind his back.
Oh,
I think it's the stylus
of
the pad.
But it looks like
a knife. And I for a second there, once I realized it was a stylus for the early pad, I was like, I'm still feel a little bit worried for Spock's best friend.
Oh, he can do some damage with that thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean...
This is why Steve Jobs did not want to have a stylus for the iPod.
That's a good point. Those guys at Palm were just vicious.
Yeah.
Yes.
Didn't want another bloodbath like that.
Never know what can happen.
Well, those guys at Palm are secretly Klingons. So.
Oh.
All right. Well, as we wrap up here, I think the point you make, Sean, is a very good one, that Spock being half-human means that he has all the human emotions. And then, as Greg, as you said, the Vulcans, they do have emotions. And as it's revealed later on as Star Trek goes on, they have emotions that may even be stronger than humans. And so they have to suppress that. Plus, he's suppressing his human emotions as well. So while that outburst, I think, is often taken as being kind of funny or, you know, like a breaking character for Spock, I actually think it was a great moment that in itself is a character moment for Spock and
especially
for
how fast he shows that emotion. Then he also goes back and he pulls his, like, almost as the Picard maneuver, he pulls his uniform down and goes back into his.
That Picard maneuver. Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say
he
quickly set the self-destruct and
run away.
But no, he puts that mask back on. He's like, you're alive.
He does. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys, to talk about Amok Time. And before we go, Michael, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
Great. Yeah. Find me on Twitter. I'm at Fats Riker Beard, where I talk about many things, including theater, Star Trek, and occasionally what brand of macaroni and cheese I'm eating. That's where I am.
Those are my favorite tweets by far. I actually favorite all those, if you've noticed.
I have.
I don't know if you get an email when I do that or not.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. And how about you, Sean?
Well, I'm on Twitter at... I can be found on Twitter at Sean Taranjo. And most of my artwork can be found on Deviant at storanjo.deviantart.com. That's storanjeau.deviantart.com.
Awesome. And we'll put some links to those in the show notes, especially for you, Sean, so everyone doesn't have to spell your last name there. So, a bit of a long one.
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, that came from my family. Not my choice.
Not
my wife
right
keeps
ass,
on
man.
Telling
cool.
me every day.
All right. Well, thanks again, guys.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, gents.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Well, I don't think we could have picked a better original series episode to do this week. I love Amok Time. I love pretty much every moment of it. I guess there's not much to say about it other than just consistently praise it. But I think we did a pretty good job covering it with Sean and Mike.
I think so. Yeah, you're right. It's just one of those episodes. As we were going along, it's like, which points do we need to hit? And because it is such, first of all, a classic episode that everyone knows so well. And it's such a well-written episode, and it gives us so many great moments that there really isn't anything to dislike about Amok Time. There are just a few things that you can laugh at, again, like the smashing the video monitor, a few things like that. But one of the great examples, I think if you were going to show anyone who had not seen the original series an episode to show the quality of TOS, definitely Amok Time is one of those episodes.
Yeah, I showed my roommate Amok Time and Space Seed this weekend. And I think her estimation of the original series grew, you know, by a few percentage points.
Great. So now next weekend, you need to show her And the Children Shall Lead and The Way to Eden.
Just to even out the average a bit.
That's right. Get you back into equilibrium there. All right, Greg. Well, let's tell everyone where they can find us if they want to share their thoughts on Amok Time or anything that we talked about today. You can go to trek.fm/contact to send us a regular email message. And of course, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, on Google Plus at hyperchannel/trekfmg+, and you can find us on Twitter at username trekfm. And that's where we're talking about Trek all the time and where most people hit us up. I would also like to remind everyone that if you like the show and you want to share your thoughts about the show, feel free to go over to iTunes and leave us a rating and a review. It does help other people find the show, and Greg and I love hearing from you and hearing your thoughts on the show. So I do invite you to do that. And Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. I'm on Twitter at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHARB as in boy, IN. Where I am honestly too busy playing MLB The Show 12 on my PlayStation to actually do any quality tweeting. But I hope to once again get back to Twitter for things other than app replies very soon.
Yeah, I knew that eventually you would get into sports games there, Greg. So
I didn't realize I love baseball. I had no idea.
You learn something every day. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. My tweet frequency is still rather low right now, but if you do follow me, give me a shout. Let me know you're there. And if you tweet to me, I will reply to you, even though I'm not actually tweeting all that much just on my own at the moment. So I would love to hear from you there. And don't forget to go by our website, trek.fm, where you can find feature articles, games, wallpapers, all kinds of things, as well as other shows. Oh, Greg, I should mention, we'll have a new Matter Stream. It's been a few weeks since we had a Matter Stream episode. We'll have a new one coming out this week by the time this Ready Room hits. And I had a wonderful interview with Morgan Gendel, the writer of The Inner Light. It's I learned a lot of interesting things about how The Inner Light came to be, his inspiration for the story, how he pitched it, how it got made. And also we talked about the graphic novel that he's doing, The Outer Light, which is currently available on trekmovie.com, which is coming out every 2 weeks, I believe, a chapter. So it's a great discussion that we had. So everyone look for that at trek.fm/ms. And also, you'll find it in iTunes. All right, Greg, I'm going to head out. You know, I haven't been getting enough sleep lately, and I'm having trouble falling asleep on top of that. So I'm going to mix up some Triox compound and inject myself and see if I can get some quality shut-eye.
All right, Chris, I think it's time to throw some Plomeek soup on it, because the Ready Room is done.